You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech happened in Washington, D.C. 50 years ago this year. And maybe if you close your eyes, you can visualize the iconic black and white film of Dr. King speaking the words as if he was saying them spontaneously from his heart in a moment of true revelation. But what is the story of those particular words in that speech? Clarence B. Jones was there. He knows the answer. He's written about it. And he's here today before delivering a keynote address at noon for one of a number of events on the UC Davis campus, recognizing and remembering the civil rights movement. Dr. Jones, it's a pleasure. Welcome to Insight.
My pleasure to be here, ma'am.
50 years. What does 50 years feel
like?
Well,
50 years is 50 years. That's, you know, we're in the... 50 years means we were going back to 1963.
Yeah.
And going back, I mean, specifically, it's August 28th, 1963. And so that there have been a number of places, and just like UC Davis is commemorating the 50th year of the I Have a Dream speech, but it's also a very important seminal point. Dr. King wrote a very profound document, the letter from a Birmingham jail, in April, some 3 months earlier. From jail, a letter from a Birmingham jail. But as this station and as institutions like UC Davis reflect back, it's important to see the 50th anniversary within the context of some seminal events that occurred there. And the seminal event that led up to the March on Washington was, of course, the Birmingham struggle itself in April to desegregate the downtown department stores. But then you had, on June 12th, 1963, the assassination of Medgar Evers, which shocked the country. You had President Kennedy having to go on a, make a public address in June 1963 because he had to federalize the National Guard to authorize, to protect the admission of Arthurine Lucy as the first black student to the University of Alabama. And this is an interesting segue, because when you think, we're here to talk about the I Have a Dream speech,
right.
But since it's just after the Super Bowl in sports, when you reflect for a moment that the President of the United States had to federalize the National Guard in order to provide armed protection to admit the first African-American student to the University of Alabama. And when you look on television now, at the University of Alabama when they played Notre Dame, or when you look at collegiate sports, sometimes I must say I get a little teared up, because I remember when I see the camaraderie and affection that goes on among the football players on the field, and then when the television pans to the audience and you see the African American white people, students in the stands, you say, my God, America, a large part of Dr. King's dream has indeed been validated. It does not mean that all of the dream has been realized, but you'd have to be deaf, dumb, and blind not to recognize that there'd been extraordinary progress since 1963, not just with the election of Barack Obama. That's just a part of it, significant part of the political part of it. But America is a different place. Is a very different kind of place. And what 50 years does, at least for me, since I remember what precipitated the I Have a Dream speech was, as I said, the Birmingham demonstrations. We don't have television here, so I'm looking across the room at you, so I'm sitting across from this very attractive announcer, and I don't know what her age is, but I can tell you this, is that in 1963, ma'am, the country, the nation was also asked, had to deal with the question of what kind of country are we? Why? Because in 1963, there were pictures of young African-American boys and girls who were peacefully demonstrating being slammed against the wall by fire hoses and police dogs nipping at them, biting them, and so forth.
In Birmingham,
Alabama.
Yeah.
And the nation and the world was shocked.
Yeah.
And in effect, collectively, the country said, what kind of nation are we? Is this who we are? Now, fast forward. You have Newtown, Connecticut, okay, in 2013, and Sandy Hook Elementary School. And we're dealing with a country where we're dealing with situations where it looks like, in some instances, we are awash in gun violence. And again, the nation is asking ourselves collectively, who are we? Is this who we are? I never will forget reading a plaintive quote in the New York Times from one of the parents who lost his child. And he was trying to understand it. And he said, they're killing our babies. They're killing our babies. Well, is America, is this who we are in America 2013? And particularly the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr., because he was America's apostle of nonviolence. More than any other person in the past 50 years, he was America's apostle of nonviolence. He said, lived, preached, acted on the basis that it's either nonviolence or nonexistence. It is, he dedicated his life to the pursuit of excellence and the resolution of conflicts nonviolently. The pursuit of excellence and the nonviolent resolution of conflict disputes. Yet the choice of the choice of the use of a gun, the choice of weaponry to resolve a civil or inevitable dispute you have in life, with whether it's at a school or in your family, or anything, that's no longer a rational choice.
Has the racism battle of 50 years ago been superseded today by the battle against violence?
I wouldn't say superseded. I'd say that it's a very profound question. I would say not superseded, but I would say that the two are intertwined. But if you, I would say categorically that it's not as if the question of our battle to reduce racism and racial and end racism, so forth, et cetera, is not an important factor. But there is no question. Your question raises the issue as whether or not, as we are having this interview this day, on whatever the date of February is, on Monday,
right,
okay, whether it may not be that the most important question confronting our country today, after the I Have a Dream speech, is the question as to whether or not we are going to be able to live as a civilized society without violence. And what's happening is that the choice of a gun, the use of a gun to resolve an otherwise dispute. Now, let me make it very, very, very clear. I don't want us to get into. I may differ with some of my liberal friends here. I don't have a problem with the Second Amendment. I absolutely don't. Okay, I understand the Second Amendment. I read it. I interpret it. I understand. The Second Amendment is as important an amendment as the First Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, 14th Amendment, so forth. Yes, enshrined in our Constitution is the right of citizens to bear arms, particularly arms in your home. No problem with that. It's the extent to which an effort is made to extend the Second Amendment rights beyond the home, beyond any rational contemplation of the founders of our country, you know? Every home should have the right to have an arm in its home to protect themselves, okay? It's still, a person's home is its castle, okay? The law, English common law, the laws of various states almost always favor a homeowner as opposed to an unwanted intruder. An unwanted intruder comes into your home to try to hurt you, and you use a reasonable amount of force to hurt them, you're going to be acquitted. They're not going to prosecute you because they recognize, one, the sacredness of your home, and two, the Second Amendment. But Second Amendment doesn't mean you got to have a magazine clip that can shoot 30 automatic, 30 bullets. Second Amendment doesn't contemplate an assault rifle, okay? doesn't, that's not what we're talking about. And I plead to my friends. I have some friends who are members of the NRA. I plead to them and say, hey, brothers and sisters, we're not, I'm with you. I want to protect you, to have your rights, to have the bear arms in your home. But let's get real. Let's get real. And interestingly enough, at least from what I read, it appears that even a substantial number of the members of the NRA is that they are not opposed to background checks, because what's at the end of the line, the question is who should have the right to even use these weapons, to own these weapons. Mm-hmm. And if, in fact, we can provide clinical objective evidence that A, B, C, D, or X, or Y are simply not mentally qualified, otherwise qualified to have a weapon, then notwithstanding the Second Amendment, they shouldn't have a weapon.
I'm talking with Dr. Clarence B. Jones, who was friend, advisor, personal counsel, and speech writer for Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. And I can tell, and in light of your book in 2008, What Would Martin Say?, that he would have been a profound voice in the gun discussion today. He would have been such an important force. And I'm sure you will be giving continued speeches and speaking out on the subject as we debate it on a national scale. I do want to hear, because you're here, a little bit about how those words happened that day. You helped write that speech. Were the words "I have a dream" originally in that speech?
No, the words "I have a dream" were not in the speech. And when you say "help write the speech," this is a matter of historical accuracy. What happened is that it's not as if Dr. King had decided on the night of August 27th, just the day before, oh, I have to sit down and what am I going to say? He had a good idea of what he was going to say. It was just a question of putting together. And the reason I said that is because in the previous two or three weeks before the March on Washington, we had had discussions about the substance of what he might say on that particular day. And my contribution was simply the fact that I knew that we had discussed various issues, and I knew he was very, very busy. And in fact, he was staying in his suite upstairs with his wife at the Willard Hotel. And although we had had some earlier discussions that evening, I knew that what he needed was to have a summary. In other words, a summary of the various ideas. So all I did was I wrote on a couple of yellow sheets of paper. I drafted a summary of the various things that we had repetitively discussed, but I put them in the form of language that he could use them if he wanted to incorporate them as a speech. In fact, I specifically said, you might want to consider this as a good opening paragraph for your speech. And you can use it, throw it away, change it, and so forth. Not until I was standing 50 feet behind him as he spoke. I had no idea until I heard him speak that he was actually speaking the words for the first six or seven paragraphs that I had written without changing a sentence, a period, or a colon. Mm.
So we just have a very little bit of time left, but there is the moment when he did utter those words, and you were there as witness.
Right.
And how did it happen? What happened?
Well, it was electrifying. First of all, the speech he gave, which is celebrated, I Have a Dream speech, was extemporaneous and spontaneous. It was extemporaneous and spontaneous because his favorite gospel singer earlier in the program had interrupted him as he was reading from the prepared text. Mahalia Jackson said, tell him about the dream, Martin, tell him about the dream. And he pushed the text aside. And as he pushed the text aside, I was standing behind him. And I said to the person standing next to me, whoever that might have been, and I said, you know, these people don't know it, but they're about ready to go to church. And I said that because I could see his stance, his posture changed as he was beginning to speak extemporaneously. It was electrifying. I've seen Dr. King and heard Dr. King speak many, many times before. Never, ever, ever, ever had I ever seen words come out of this man's body like that on that day at that time.
The full story of that day and that speech is in a book which came out in 2011 called Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed
the Nation. Yes.
And it is really a wonderful book, and you give excerpts of the book in various speeches.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
And it's so, I wish we had 3 hours to talk about the whole book here today, but we will wrap this up and leave people with the sound from that speech and some of the memory of that day. And I want to let folks know that you'll be speaking today on the UC Davis campus.
Yes, I am.
At noon.
At the law school, the University of Davis Law School, right?
It is an event organized by the UC Davis Law School at the UC Davis Conference Center. We have more information, and there's a question and answer period
and it's free and open
to the public.
Absolutely, yes.
And wonderful that people can kind of touch this with you, because there is Martin Luther King Jr.'s King Hall on campus, there's a nice celebration there. And I want to thank you so much, Dr. Jones, and just if you have a final word or thought about where we are today taking the legacy forward, what would that be?
Very simply, as I said earlier, is that the choice confronting our nation is we have to find a way of resolving our disputes nonviolently. It's either nonviolence or nonexistence. We will just descend into utter chaos without a commitment to nonviolence.
Dr. Clarence B. Jones, you're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio, and here's the finale of Dr. King delivering his speech 50 years ago.
When we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."